You want to get yourself a drink, you know, and you feel you couldn't while Tim was speaking, now you can. And we will move into the time where we can question Tim and find out what he really knows. I'll kick us off. Obviously, this is very much a messianic psalm. This is about Jesus. It says at the beginning that it's a psalm of David, so assume it's King David. I wonder what he would have thought of it, what he thought he was writing. How would he understand it? We know David had a lot of problems with King Saul and a few other times. But is this relate to a particular time, do you think, that he was in? Or do you think what would make him write these words?
Okay. It's a job to know exactly how much King David did or didn't know. Is the fulfillment of this psalm exclusively in Jesus and at Jesus' time, or is there some sort of partial fulfillment in the life of David and according to his experience at that time? Was it a split prophecy, or was it completely intended for fulfillment in the Messiah, in Jesus? Yeah, it's impossible, or it's very difficult to answer that question completely. But what I would say is this. Now, this applies to another psalm, but what we read in Acts chapter 2, particularly as he's talking, Peter's talking in Acts chapter 2, he's talking about Psalm 16, another psalm of David. He says, "Brothers, I can tell you confidently that the patriarch David died and was buried, and his tomb is here to this day. But he was a prophet and knew that God had promised him on oath that he would place one of his descendants on his throne. Seeing what was ahead, he spoke of the resurrection of Christ, that he was not abandoned to the grave, nor did his body see decay." So, he saw quite a lot, I think. I think that helps us understand that he was able to deduce quite a lot. Yeah, through early prophecy, yeah.
Yeah, I think that I guess when you're a songwriter, things just come to you and you write them because they feel good, they seem right, and so maybe David felt like that. I also wondered about we like to think that, you know, a lot of these messianic parts of the Old Testament should convince the Jews that Jesus was the Messiah. But if you try and put yourself in the position of a Jew, they would probably say, no, this is obviously about the Jewish nation. We're the people who suffer. Mm-hmm. And we trust God for the future. So it's one of those where you think, this should get them, but it won't. Because the suffering of the Jewish people means that a lot of these kind of passages they would see as relating to them and as being a lot of poetic language. So, I mean, pierced hands and feet seems so exact, doesn't it? And yet, if you don't want to see it, you don't see it. That's my two pennies. Right. Questions? Comments? Has Tim completely answered every thought and question you've had? We have this problem, don't we? We're not good at asking questions or critically analysing and saying, oh, you said this, but this. Then I'll throw out a question to everyone else. What psalms do you find particularly speak to you? Either about Jesus or that mean something to you? I'll give you a couple of minutes to think about that, because I'll tell you that mine is Psalm 63. I'm just going to run through to it. There we are. It's another David psalm, but they're just coincidence. And it's the one which goes, God, you are my God, earnestly I seek you. I thirst for you, my whole being longs for you. To me, I think it's partly, as a worship leader, to me it's that desire for God and to express that need for God and that desire to praise him at all times. It says, I'll praise you as long as I live, and in your name I'll lift up my hands. On my bed I remember you. I think of you through the watches of the night. And that's the psalm that speaks to me the most. So what other psalms are special to us? What resonates? Jackie, you going to say something?
Nope. I was going to say, mine is 139. It's just beautiful all the way through. But the thing that always gets me with the Psalms is that they always end up with the condemnation. Even your lovely 63 there was, those who seek my life will be destroyed. We know David struggled, didn't he, with his enemies. Yet we're called, aren't we, to love our enemies. It's always a bit of a dichotomy for me, that one. Even 139 ends when I read it out at work. I tend to leave out the last bit because it all turns a little bit violent.
So what's a couple of key verses from there that actually speak to you in that psalm?
Well, definitely the fact that you can't hide from God. And that's a good thing. We don't want to hide from God, that he's there in the darkness and the light, in the rejoicing and the despair, he's there. So that's why I love that one.
Thank you, Jackie. That is a problem, Tim, isn't it, with the Psalms, that they often seem quite violent and very unchristian.
Yeah, I mean, there are probably about half dozen Psalms in the Book of Psalms which are called the imprecatory Psalms, which are Psalms of curse. And it is very difficult to understand because they appear to be saying pretty ungodly things. And a number of different commentators and scholars have different approaches to the imprecatory Psalms. There aren't easy explanations, put it that way. Maybe we should choose one Sunday evening and have a go.
We have a hand.
Here we go. Thank you, Graham. I wanted to comment on the previous David being a prophet. I also wanted to just chip in that I believe, because it was said in Acts 13:22 that he was a man after the heart of God, that God was able to reveal quite a lot to him because he had that relationship with God. And if you're not in a place of prayer, a place of worship, I don't think you can get those revelation if you're busy with life or busy with warfare, you know, going about your business. But if you actually have an intimate relationship with God, and God calls you friend, and he says that you're after my heart, and you deliberately seeking the heart of God, God cannot but reveal his heart to you. And I think that's why, expositionally, he was able to see a lot that he did about the coming Messiah. That's just my random thought. But secondly, my favorite psalm from childhood has always been Psalms 27. And the bit that I like the most is verse 5, I think 4 and 5. That's the one thing only, that I ask of the Lord, that I seek after, is that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple. That's my prayer, and something I've always praised since I was a child. And that's why people mock me. They say that I'm part of the furniture. You know, I'm always in church. Don't I have a life? Oh, there you go again. But that's my prayer and always my desire.
Okay. Had time to think about your particular psalm, or have a comment? Here you go, Mike.
I just wanted to comment, like Sujit did, on the psalm we've just had. It's been, I remember someone saying about Psalm 23 following Psalm 22, and why is that? You know, why did the Jewish church put that in that order? Once again, sort of prophetic things were working out there, but I heard one person say, well, look, you know, you have to go through Psalm 22 before you reach Psalm 23. And, you know, how true is that? You know, in order for our salvation is about the cross. We have to come through the cross in order to experience Psalm 23. We all know Psalm 23, you know, everyone knows it, but they don't want to go into Psalm 23. They don't want to spend too much time on Psalm 22. But of course, if you're a Christian, you've come through that, you know, being born again, you're dying to repentance, and that's important.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, we would far rather dwell in Psalm 23 than we would Psalm 22. We would far rather have the green pastures, the still waters, the plenty. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Shall not be in need of anything. But, as you said, very often we have to go through Psalm 22 to get to Psalm 23. And I think it is as much a part of the Christian experience. And certainly it was Jesus' experience as we see him suffering on the cross from Psalm 22. And that's the encouragement and the admonition of the writer to Hebrews, as we saw it in that particular verse or verses in Hebrews chapter 4, that Jesus has been where we are. Therefore, he knows, he understands, and he can empathize. And the big exhortation is that to hold on to that faith which we profess, because Jesus knows and understands what we're going through. But yeah, we experientially, we don't like being there. But I think, personally, I think in Psalm 22, there is so much wisdom and so much truth which can help us when Jesus does seem far off and when we are facing ridicule and persecution. Where did Jesus go? Well, we can see where he went. And you know, I was hearing about this just this past week. You know, so often, in fact, even today, with the whole remembrance and armistice, we've heard so many stories about World War I and the heroes, and it encourages us to hear that, and it strengthens us, and it gives us hope, and it really, you know, makes us feel good. You know, and I think the same is true in the Christian life as well. We don't often hear the stories of old, do we? We don't often hear those testimonies of how God has delivered. Whatever that is. In the nick of time, God came through. And we just don't seem to tell those stories that much to one another these days. But that's exactly where Jesus went. He remembered the fathers who went before. In you they trusted. They were delivered. They were not put to shame. And somehow, through speaking those things, he found trust to hang on. Now, he went off the cliff pretty quick because he said in verse 6, but I am a worm, not a man. But that's part of the struggle he was going through. That's part of the wrestling. That's part of our experience as well. And so in that way, we can learn from Jesus.
Any other hands? Damn it.
My favorite psalm is 91 and verse 15. He shall call upon him and he will answer him. He will be with him in trouble. He will deliver him in honest. Okay. Why I like this psalm is when I'm going through something, I use that psalm so much to encourage myself and to pray more. Because sometimes I do ask for things and it's not coming, but I still wait upon the Lord. Because I believe His ways are not my ways. And at His own appointed time, He's going to answer me. So I hold on to that.
I think that I'll just say my bit. The interesting thing is, you know, the order of the Psalms, to our mind, everything ought to have some sort of order. It should be alphabetical or chronological or thematic. But the Psalms aren't like that. If you look at your typical hymn book, the hymns don't relate to each other at all. They don't tend to get them in blocks of themes or anything. And if you think of the Psalms like that, you know, that there are groups, songs of ascents and songs of the sons of Korah and things like that, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they actually follow any logic as to being similar. There's a group of praisey ones at the end, but even that isn't completely all the same style, and so there's quite a variation in there, and we do need to think, this is not modern British culture that's produced this, and be prepared to absorb something different. Gabby.
With the different animals, did they use those ones for specific reasons, or were they just any sort of animal? Like, why did they choose those ones?
Yeah, I mean, when it talks about the bulls of Bashan, they were pretty meaty, chunky, nasty creatures, apparently. I mean, Bashan was a very fertile area, lots of lush grass, nutrition, and they grew them big there. And I think that's why it refers to the bulls of Bashan. Yeah, I'm not sure if there's kind of typology beyond that. The lions, the dogs. I mean, it would be interesting to go back and to look at these various animals and to look at the various groups, identify the various groups of people who were there at the crucifixion of Jesus, and to try and align who could be who. And you might find similar characteristics there. How literal the psalm is in that regard would be interesting to study. I don't know if other people have a thought there.
I'd say that I think the it's not that literal, and that obviously to that generation, certain animals represented certain kinds of aggression, obviously, in this case. I mean, we still use dogs as a derogatory term.
Yeah.
And of course, bulls, particularly wild bulls in Africa, are well known for being very dangerous. And they're not like the cows that we have in our pastures, perhaps.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's interesting because you see the bulls and the lions in that descent into death, mentioned in verse 12 and then verse 13, but then you hop all the way over to verse 16 for dogs. And then tucked in the middle there is verse 15b, you lay me, God, in the dust of death. But then it says with reference to the dogs, band of evil men have encircled me, pierced my hands, my feet, count on my, so these dogs are the ones who pierced his hands and his feet, which may be referring to the Roman soldiers, if you line it up with the gospel narratives.
I'm just wondering, thinking out loud, as David was a shepherd, would that possibly go into when he was younger and all the animals which came onto him and tried to attack his flock? Just, he had, obviously knew, didn't he, when he was the shepherd boy, and the fact that he protected his sheep from so many different animals, I wonder if that's coming into David's, what he's trying to describe as well. So
yeah.
It may not be as literal, but I imagine, would he come across the bulls of Bashan and stuff, or
yeah.
the different dogs which he would protect
yeah.
his sheep from? So,
yep. No,
yeah,
that's,
just wondered.
Yeah. Take your point, yeah.
yeah. Certainly he mentions lions and probably wild dogs were an issue. Any more thoughts? Any input? Looks like we're done. That's trouble when you do a short bit of Bible, you know, just one psalm. Okay. Chris, I'll move
okay,
to this.
Graham's got a question.
Oh, we haven't finished. Graham. Okay.
Just a couple of obscure points to try and link on. Roaring lions are in, well, in Peter, a roaring lion is like the devil who prowls around seeking someone to devour. And we can see perhaps in this a shadow of the action of the devil, which then goes back to Genesis 3:15 about he shall bruise your heel and you shall crush his head. That links in with that. And it also speaks of the dust. And we see, again, linking back in Genesis, that it was the serpent who was cursed by God, and on your belly you shall move and crawl and eat the dust of the earth. So it seems almost that that's a kind of link with devil's food, if you like, and what sustains the devil in his action. Maybe a bit imaginative or far-fetched, but then sometimes that's what the Bible does.
Right, okay. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, I do think it's dangerous to push some of the allegories too far. But certainly it's good to be aware of how different scriptures link together and be able to cross-reference them. It helps understanding a lot. Okay, right. I have one more question for everybody, if they want to answer it or not. Where do we turn when God seems distant? Because we all go through these times, don't we, when we feel God just isn't there anymore. There's this emptiness or a barrier between me and God. There's this problem, and I don't know what it is. Is our attitude like Jesus and the psalmist to say, I just trust because that's all there is? Because I think, you know, when we get to those places, we have two options. We can just hang on and say, God, I know that you're real. I know that you're there, although you don't feel like it. Or we can say, well, if I can't feel God, I'm not interested anymore, and just walk away. And maybe sometimes, you know, we need to be aware of where we all are and encourage each other to trust God and to know that he is there, whatever the circumstances are. Because to me, there is nowhere else to go. You know, if you don't stay with Jesus, anything else is pretty meaningless. And it doesn't meet that need that we have to be part of God's plan. Oh, you need to talk to the mic, Graham.
I was just coming back to say that the book of Job is a great example of believing in spite of all evidence to the contrary. And Job did not know what the behind-the-scenes battle was about. All he knew was his own misfortune. He even had his wife saying, why don't you just curse God and die? And how tempting that is when nothing seems to be going right, when our whole world is collapsing, and yet God's promises are there that, you know, I will be with you and I will not forsake you, and everything cries out within you, that is not true. And but that Job and this psalm are two big things we need to grab hold of in such times.
Yeah, I think Tim's quite keen to do Job at some point, which would be good. Okay, speaking of, one last thought.
Sorry, yeah, it's interesting. I mean, just in our closing time here, a lot of the questions have been about grasping their trust and Jesus' experience in the first 21 verses. And so often that's where we gravitate in Psalm 22, is to those first 21 verses. And yet we see this marvelous picture. Once that death and resurrection has taken place, the gospel just goes out to the ends of the earth. And just those ripples keep coming, keep coming, keep coming. And as far as I can see, in order for that prophecy to come to pass, we're part of it. Who's going to tell these people, as we saw in verse, 30-31? You know, it's not going to happen unless we're involved in the prophecy. And equally important to verses 1 through 21 is 22 through 31. And so often we do tend to neglect those verses, and they are just so, so important. Yeah.
Thanks, Tim. That's important. Yeah, because it's so easy to kind of dwell. It's all about me and my situation, but God has a plan. And so often, isn't it, that when you think that things should be much better, problems come. Issues come, because when God is working, Satan is working as well, and he likes to draw us down and make us feel that the situation is hopeless and make us see only one side of what God's doing. Right, the next